You're with us on Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, the Milwaukee Brewers missed the playoffs this year for the first time since 2017. We'll check in with a Brewers broadcaster about what went wrong this season and where it leaves the team heading into next year. Now, the U.S. Soccer Federation released an investigative report this week by former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, which uncovered systemic verbal and emotional abuse and sexual misconduct in the National Women's Soccer League. Yates' report found that coaches manipulated and harassed players while executives ignored and dismissed complaints. U.S. Women's National Team captain Becky Sarbrunn, who plays for the Portland Thorns Football Club in the National Women's Soccer League, is calling for the removal of owners and executives that failed to protect the players from this abuse.
We are angry that it took a third-party investigation. We are angry that it took an article in The Athletic and The Washington Post and numerous others. We're angry that it took over 200 people sharing their trauma to get to this point right now.
The investigation, just the latest in a trend of abuse in women's sports and at the highest levels. We want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. What can we do to protect our female athletes? What are your thoughts about the abuse reported in women's soccer? How do you think women's sports can better protect their women? 1-800-642-1234 to join us. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our guest is Sally Jenkins, a sports columnist for the Washington Post. She was the first woman to be inducted into the National Sportscasters and Sportswriters Hall of Fame, and she was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2019. She wrote a column this week entitled Another Report on Abuse in Women's Sports. When is enough enough? Sally, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Would you take us through some of the details of the report and what stood out to you the most?
Well, the main thing that stands out is the grainy, disgustingly grainy detail that Sally Yates included in the report of the ways in which coaches were abusing, you know, some of our greatest athletes, sexual coercion, calling them the P word and the C word, putting them in very awkward, compromising positions, pressuring them for sex, denigrating them on a daily basis. That sort of thing really stood out the most.
And yet, Sally, this wasn't a few coaches. This wasn't a handful. This report included complaints against coaches for half of the teams in the NWSL. So how does abuse like this become so rampant, so systemic across an entire league?
I don't know about you, but I'm getting very tired of the word systemic. In these cases, the word systemic essentially means everybody knew. What it means is that the men at the top of these organizations, owners, U.S. soccer officials, received complaints, received reports, credible reports of abuse and inappropriate actions by coaches, and they simply failed to act. Well, what that does is it allows the abuse to spread even further. It creates more victims. It creates more complainants. And that is what systemic really is. It means everybody knew and nobody did anything.
And is that the takeaway from the Yates report?
It certainly is. One of the things that the Yates report, the second thing that will make you angriest in reading the Yates report is after the grainy detail comes the total inaction by those people who could have prevented this.
And as you point out in your article, Sally Jenkins, it's Sally Yates who says these are our top athletes. And if these are our top athletes in the world, what does that mean for those who aren't the top athletes? What does it mean for those who are just trying to get to that upper echelon of women's sports?
Well, right. How many great young women athletes have fallen by the wayside because they couldn't put up with it? They couldn't take it. It was too gross. It was too hard. One of the things Yates describes is the way in which this starts in youth soccer. One of the coaches that the report focuses on, Rory Dames, to this day, still is permitted to coach youth soccer. Now, this is a guy who's described in the report as saying to his young charges that they should be shaved and bare down there. This is a guy who was making profoundly inappropriate remarks to young women. This is a guy who called them the P word, called them the C word. You know, this guy has no business coaching, and yet he was enabled at every level of the U.S. soccer system. And he was also furthermore enabled by Safe Sport, the organization that's supposed to deal with complaints of abuse, which refused to fully suspend him when it did receive a complaint.
Sally Jenkins, our guest, sports columnist for the Washington Post, and we invite you into this conversation. If you've seen something similar in women's sports, or if you are concerned about how you can best protect your young student athlete, join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Sally Jenkins, you write about the U.S. Center for Safe Sport in your article. Can you explain how it came to be and what it's supposed to be doing and how it fell short according to the Yates report?
Well, Safe Sport was a mechanism put in place by both the U.S. Olympic Committee and Congress after the Larry Nassar gymnastics scandal as a way to deal with athletes who may have complaints of sexual abuse or physical abuse or any other sort of abuse against coaches or people in positions of power under the Olympic umbrella. As the Yates report vividly describes, however, this mechanism or this agency is doing absolutely nothing, next to nothing. They, in one period, handled about 15 cases and 1,500 cases. And as the Yates reports discovered, they managed to administratively stymie 1,300 of those cases. Only about 122 cases reached any sort of formal resolution. So you can make a complaint to Safe Sport, but the vast, vast chance is that nothing will ever come of it. As Yates said, those complaints wind up administratively closed without ever being publicized, without ever being acted on, and apparently without ever being fully vetted.
So how is this supposed to protect our female athletes?
Well, I mean, that's the question. There really is no protection for our female athletes or our young athletes right now. You know, Safe Sport isn't working. There are 30 Safe Sport employees to deal with 11 million American athletes under the Olympic or National Federation umbrella. They have a budget of about $23 million. And frankly, you know, that's just woefully inadequate. It's not clearly not getting the job done. And not only that, but frequently Safe Sport's jurisdiction actually acts as a preventative. So U.S. Soccer at a couple different junctures might have liked to have done something about these coaches, but Safe Sport's jurisdiction was so confusing that it actually prevented them from acting more firmly.
So it became a red tape issue that actually endangered our female athletes.
Correct. The red tape and the bureaucracy is not protecting anybody. It's if anything, it's just proving to be a mechanism for burying complaints in complete, you know, bureaucratic darkness.
Sally, what have we seen since the Yates report came out? Has there been some movement in the National Women's Soccer League?
I mean, it's been a stunning silence, really. The statements, the only people who have made firm statements or bold statements or any statements at all, for that matter, really, are the players. You know, Becky Sauerbrunn's statement was incredibly powerful and moving. Now, there have been a couple of firings in Portland, but quite honestly, it's the very, very top of the pyramid where we need to be looking for some accountability. And if you ask me, the reason why we keep seeing reports like this from whether it's gymnastics, swimming, taekwondo, why do we go through this hygiene theater time after time where we have an investigation by a large newspaper exposes a federation like gymnastics or in this case soccer. The embarrassed officials then commission an independent report by someone like Sally Yates. The report comes out and it turns out the abuse was much bigger and broader and worse than anybody knew. And no one ever pays the price for that except the athletes. We go back to more bureaucratic shuffling. So to me, until there's some fear in the hearts of these administrators at the top of the federations, as Becky Sauerbrunn said, until those people go, we're going to keep repeating this cycle, unfortunately.
Sally Jenkins, you are a Hall of Fame sports writer, and so I would be curious to know how important you saw the journalism done by The Atlantic and The Washington Post in setting the stage for this Yates investigation.
I mean, it was everything. Molly Hensley Clancy's investigative pieces in The Washington Post and Meg Linen's pieces in The Athletic were the spurs for the entire Yates report. And if not for the journalistic investigations, there never would have been a Yates report. Sally Yates would never have been hired by U.S. Soccer. You know, unfortunately, it takes accountability in the press, and it takes real shame and real pressure before these bodies – do the right thing. And even then, you know, they commission the report. And again, it's sort of hygiene theater. It's this public, you know, cleanse, but nothing significant or consequential really happens to the people in charge who bottom drawered and shelved these complaints. I mean, these complaints were from some of our top Olympians or top collegians. There was no reason to doubt their credibility. There was no reason to doubt that Kristen Press was telling the truth. You know, a two-time Olympian and World Cup champion was telling the truth when she said, hey, this coach has a problem. This organization has a problem. You know, when she's complaining about a Rory Dames or a Christy Holly, you know, when an Alex Morgan says that Paul Riley should not be our Olympic coach because he's relentlessly pursued athletes sexually against their will. Why was that not attended to and acted on instantly by the top of U.S. soccer?
You can imply your own answer there. We're talking to award-winning Washington Post sports columnist Sally Jenkins about a new report of widespread abuse in professional women's soccer. And as Sally mentions, there's taekwondo, there's gymnastics, of course, even equestrian, swimming, skiing, you name it. So what can we do to protect our female athletes? What's it going to take? What do you think of the Yates Report? I invite you to join us at 1-800-642-1234. Why do you think we see so much abuse across women's sports? 800-642-1234 or email us ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Sally Jenkins, an award-winning author and sports columnist with The Washington Post. With us today discussing a new investigative report of abuse by coaches and executives in women's professional soccer. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the abuse in women's soccer? And if you're a parent, these reports make you hesitant to let your daughter get into sports. And how do you think women's sports can better protect their athletes? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. And Sally, what were some of the main recommendations from the Yates report, and how effective do you think they would be?
Well, the one recommendation that the Yates report makes that I like best of all is they say that the people involved with the Women's Soccer League should not be eligible for any sort of non-disparagement or non-disclosure agreement. She calls for total transparency in terms of dealing with why coaches are fired, why they're released. Because one of the things that happened here was that a coach was fired for cause, as it turns out, and then it was covered up and hushed as to what the real reasons for his firing, you know, were. And he goes on to coach at another organization and therefore abuse more players. So that has to stop. We have to have mechanisms in our federations and our Olympic umbrella sports that make it clear that if you want to be involved with the national team on any level, whether you're an official or a coach, you forfeit your right to sort of non-disclosure agreements because you're dealing with people's daughters, you're dealing with people's children, you're dealing with a national resource, our greatest athletes. You are not entitled to operate at will and then hide your misdeeds behind a non-disclosure agreement in your contract or your buyout. So that has to stop. That has to stop. When a Steve Penny, you know, has to step down from USA Gymnastics, or a Scott Blackman has to step down from the USOC because they have, with their inaction, enabled a team doctor to molest our gold medal gymnasts for years at a time, there needs to be total transparency on exactly why those people are being moved out of their chairs.
And what about you, Sally Jenkins? You've seen it all in sports at this point. And you know, what do you think needs to change to protect female athletes?
Look, I'm 62 years old, and I've been writing these stories since I was 22 years old. And I would like to know, you know, exactly when we're going to get a grip on this thing. So one of the things, you know, that I would like to see, actually, Congress is going to convene some hearings on this report, just like they did on the Larry Nassar situation in gymnastics. And Senator Richard Blumenthal came out a couple of days ago and said, you know, they'll be looking into this just like they did gymnastics. I want some real teeth from Congress this time. I would like to see some sort of measure that makes it a crime. If you're involved in our Olympic program or our national sports programs in any way, and you receive a report that an athlete is being abused and you do not immediately act on it and conduct a full fact-finding operation, you should be charged with a crime. Because essentially what you are doing is jeopardizing the health of scores more athletes.
Sally, I'm thinking about if these athletes had more security, financial security specifically, if they would have more power within their sport. And that leads me to the pay gap in women's sports. Does that play into this dynamic at all?
You know, I think it has because, you know, if you look at something even as sort of comparatively benign as the way the NCAA was treating women's basketball players a couple years ago, where they got inferior treatment at their tournament. They didn't even get a proper weight room. They were getting inferior food. All of that says, well, it's just women. You know, women aren't, I mean, some of the people in the soccer organization weren't even being, you know, put through background checks. They weren't being properly vetted the way you would vet someone who is going to scout or coach for the men's national team. You know, we value our young men more than our young women. It's that simple. Well, one thing that attitude does is it's a magnet for abusers. You know, there's enormous leverage for coaches. There's only one path to the national team and the Olympics, and it's through these guys, right? It's through these coaches, youth coaches, national team, junior team coaches, national team coaches. They have the ability to completely blockade your career, which gives them huge power over the athletes. And just like a college player has to rely on the head coach for the maintenance of their scholarship. And so that relationship bears really close examination. But in women's sports, we haven't been looking at it very closely because, you know, it's just women.
Sally Jenkins, sports columnist for The Washington Post, and we invite you into the conversation as we discuss the Yates investigation into the National Women's Soccer League and the fact that more than it was about half of the teams in the National Women's Soccer League received complaints against their coach. What can be done about that?
Not only did they receive complaints, exactly half were fired.
Wow. Let's go to your calls at 1-800-642-1234, where Jen in Madison is standing by. Jen, you're on the air with Sally Jenkins.
Hi, Sally. First of all, I really appreciate you highlighting this topic, and I'm just going to set my rage aside for a minute and ask this question. So it's a good question to ask what we can change in women's sports, but can you put this situation in the context of what women are experiencing in general, like loss of body autonomy and what that says? I mean, these women suffered abuse of their bodies and weren't treated with respect and rights, and we're seeing that as a larger societal issue. Can you sort of say, do you think we can make changes with, you know, in athletics with what's going on in a larger societal sense?
Jen, thank you. Sally.
I do. You know, I think Title IX is the closest thing to an equal rights amendment that was ever passed in this country. You know, it's had a seismic effect. And one of the things it's done is it's created, you know, generations and generations of women who are actually equipped to coach themselves. It's given women a sense of ownership of their own bodies. It's made strong the new beautiful. And one of the things I think we could see here is I would like to see more coaching jobs going to women. You know, why is it that we have these men, these guys who are really sort of second-rate guys from overseas, frankly, a lot of these guys are from England, come over here, and they get jobs working into like junior level, lower level tiers of our national soccer program. Why aren't those jobs going to, you know, our best female prospects to be head coaches? You know, that's one thing I think I'd like to see. But in terms of the broader societal question, you know, obviously, you know, you have cases like Walmart where, you know, women weren't being promoted and they filed a class action suit that they actually ended up losing because they just weren't being promoted at the same clip. I mean, you look at law firm partners, you look at, you know, STEM, you look at Silicon Valley, and yeah, it's still a real uphill battle for women and to be promoted and to, you know, gain sort of, you know, equal treatment in the workplace. You know, disparate treatment is still a really, really profound problem in the society. And God forbid you be a Black woman, you know? There's something to it. It's, again, we're talking about generations of valuing boys over girls. and young men over our young women. It's changing. There's been some tremendous change since I've been doing this, since I was 22 years old, thanks to people like my great late friend, Pat Summitt, or Tara Vanderveer at Stanford. But we just have a long way to go when our greatest gold medal athletes have to suffer physical abuse in silence. Something is sick in our society.
Sally Jenkins, is there something, and we're just about out of time, but as a fan of women's soccer, is there something we should be doing to support these athletes?
Well, I think one thing everyone should do is take a real close look at who you're entrusting your daughter to in youth soccer. And at the high school and collegiate level, and make sure these people are licensed. Make one of these guys wasn't even licensed. Okay. So first of all, make sure that they are licensed by a governing body to be a coach in the first place. That's one thing you can do. But the second thing you can do is you can talk to your senator who may be sitting on some of these hearings and let them know that you want the suits at these organizations to have a little fear in their hearts about the consequences for them the next time they ignore a complaint of abuse from a young woman athlete.
Do you think we're going in the right direction here, Sally? Are you optimistic that we're making at least some progress with this Yates report?
I mean, yeah, the Yates report is great, but I'll be honest with you, until a man in charge of one of these federations is literally sent to jail in handcuffs, I'm not sure we're going to see a profound change. There has to be some sort of accountability, just with any other kind of white collar crime. You know, until a stock trader or a hedge funder goes to prison for their malfeasance, you don't see, you know, these businesses straightening up. And the same thing is true here. This is a problem that has run rampant. We've had people at the top be able to act with impunity for generations. And it's going to take putting some fear in their hearts to change this.
Sally, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Sally Jenkins, award-winning sports columnist for The Washington Post, the author of 12 books, with us today to discuss the new report of widespread abuse in professional women's soccer and the column that she wrote for The Washington Post entitled, Another Report on Abuse in Women's Sports, When Is Enough Enough? And you can continue to chime in on this on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. The Milwaukee Brewers are playing their final game of the season today, but they were already eliminated from playoff contention earlier this week. It's the first time the Brew Crews missed the postseason since 2017. They started the season playing like the best team in the National League Central Division, but since Memorial Day, the Brewers lost more games than they won, and Milwaukee couldn't turn it back around in time to hold a spot in the playoffs. Dominic Catronio is the host of the Brewers Extra Innings postgame show on WTMJ. He also hosts the Locked On Brewers podcast. Dominic, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and let's start with a brief synopsis of the season, where the expectations were when we started, how the season progressed, and how we ended up out of the playoffs.
Yeah, you really alluded to it well, though, that first 50 games, best start in franchise history. You look at the excitement around this team of the new acquisitions. You had Corbin Burnes still kicking, firing on all cylinders, being one of the best pitchers in baseball the first month and a half, 2 months of the season. And right around Memorial Day is when things started to shift and that the offense started to get cold, and then they started to deal with injuries. I think one of the first major injuries the Brewers had to deal with was missing Willy Adames for a month. And then they had to deal with Brandon Woodruff getting hurt. And then they had to deal with maybe the biggest blow, Freddy Peralta, missing about 2.5, almost 3 months in the middle of the season of not being able to keep going with a shoulder issue. The good news for the Brewers, though, is that it was never a surgical issue for Freddy. In fact, he's pitched in the last couple of days here in the finale of the season that he's come back healthy. But a big story of the season will be injuries. But perhaps the biggest story of them all was on the trading deadline when the Brewers traded all-star closer Josh Hader for a couple of prospects and two other big league relievers, one of which they immediately released upon acquiring Denelson Lamet, and the other one, Taylor Rogers, who, quite frankly, underperformed in his time here in Milwaukee. So a lot of Brewers fans were really frustrated by the loss of Hader in addition to the lack of a return, in their opinion. But it's only time will tell about the prospects returned in Este Uri Ruiz and Robert Gasser in that trade. And then the offense went silent and there were a lot of close games on the stretch that the Brewers were winning in the first half that, quite frankly, didn't turn their way in the second half.
Yeah, and Dom, the story about the Josh Hader trade at the deadline, I believe that was about the last time we caught up with you about the Brewers this season, and that being a turning point as Brewers, many Brewers fans saw it, but it's not like Josh Hader performed that well once he was traded off from the Brewers, did he?
And he wasn't performing well even in the beginning of July. It was the worst month statistically of his entire career. And the Brewers were maybe a little bit worried because we know how the Brewers operate. They're a small market team. They trade stars at their highest return level in order to return prospects. And the quote that David Stearns used that's been repeated over and over and over again is take as many bites at the apple as possible. And for Josh Hader, his first couple of weeks in San Diego were very odd. In fact, for a brief time, he was removed from the closer's role for the Padres. But in the last month and a month and a half or so, he has righted the ship. He is back to normal Josh Hader. And he brings a lot of postseason experience to that ball club that does not have a lot of postseason experience. So the Brewers will certainly have conflicted feelings watching the Padres in the postseason, given they're sitting on their living room couches the rest of this October.
Dominic Catronio is the host of the Brewers Extra Innings postgame show on WTMJ, also hosts the Locked On Brewers podcast. And how hot is Milwaukee Brewers manager Craig Counsell's seat at the end of this season?
I look at it that his seat is room temperature.
Okay.
You know, it didn't change in one way or another. I quite frankly commend Counsell for what he's had to go through this season, like you said, with the injuries, but also the changes. I mean, that's a lot to weigh on a clubhouse. And not only Josh Hader is a big, you know, departure from this team in trades, you also have to look back to late May when the Brewers officially designated for assignment Lorenzo Cain. Not only a fan favorite and a legendary Brewer on some great playoff teams, he was a clubhouse favorite, a clubhouse leader, a veteran. And that impacted the clubhouse, but they felt like they could withstand that. And he was always going to be a fan from afar. It was a mutual classy move by the Brewers to do to release him after he achieved 10 years of service time, which basically means he's able to max out his Major League Baseball pension. It was a very classy thing to do, but to have two major blows of chemistry in your clubhouse, it's so hard to quantify, obviously, for nerds like me, but the point is, chemistry is a real thing, and a lot of players have alluded to it all season. Something's been off the entire second half, and it's very easy to point at the Josh Hader trade.
So then, Dom, I have to ask, how hot is the seat for the front office of the Milwaukee Brewers?
I think for the first time in a long time, it's a step above room temperature. I'm not ready to say, oh, David Stearns and Matt Arnold are on the hot seat. Maybe, you know, we have to let this play out. But one bad trade as it looks in 2 months, maybe won't look like a bad trade in 2 years. So I think this is going to be a very important offseason, though, for David Stearns and company, because it's clear this team needs some offense. There will be some key departures coming up, like Colton Wong is not expected to be returning to the team under a team option. You'll also have to replace maybe Omar Narvaez. You'll have to figure out what you're doing at third base. So there are some question marks still on this team to figure out what are you going to do in 2023 to make them better and get back into the postseason.
Is the window closing for opportunities to make it all the way back to the series at some point for the Milwaukee Brewers? Is rebuilding on the horizon? What's next for this team?
That's why this offseason is so important, because you are nearing that crossroads. For those who don't know, the arbitration process generally takes 3 years, the last 3 years of a player's time in the big leagues before he hits free agency. So right now, heading into this offseason, it'll be the second year for Brandon Woodruff, for Corbin Burnes, for Devin Williams, for Willy Adames, the main core, Rowdy Tellez. Hunter Renfroe will be heading into his third year of arbitration, meaning after next season, he will be a free agent. So it's easy to say, yes, the window is closing, but at the same time, there is an opportunity to maybe extend Corbin Burnes or Brandon Woodruff to send out a signal to the rest of the league and the rest of this clubhouse saying, no, we're not going to a rebuild. David Stearns has made that clear. They do not intend on rebuilding. And that's where the as many bites out of the apple comes from. And it's amazing that the floor has risen to this level of saying they expect to make the postseason every single year, which I know a lot of Brewers fans here in Milwaukee for years and years and years know that wasn't always the case back in the 90s and the early 2000s. So it is refreshing to have urgency and to have a team that should be able to be make it to the World Series, because pitching is always what carries you. So there is a little bit of urgency this offseason to figure out that is this window going to be extended, or are you going to go full on youth movement for 23 and 24?
Dominic, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure.
Dominic Catronio is the host of the Brewers Extra Innings postgame show on WTMJ, also hosting the Locked on Brewers podcast. With us today looking at how the Milwaukee Brewers missed the playoffs this season and where it leaves the franchise going forward. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Maureen McCollum with a name origin for a corner of the state.
As people enter the Driftless area of southwestern Wisconsin, they're transported from a relatively flat region to a sudden maze of rolling hills. Roads wind up the sides of bluffs and then back down to the valleys below. Its beauty is without question. But where does the name Driftless come from? That's a question sent to WPR's Wisconsin Project. WPR's Jonah Balekas hit the winding roads to find the answer for us.
Water flows through a stream in the Kickapoo Valley Reserve in Vernon County. Sandstone and limestone rock appear on a bluffside with white pine and yellow birch trees. I'm off a hiking trail after wading through wildflowers and other native plant life. While living in Madison, Claire Holland scratched her itch to explore by driving west through the bluffs and valleys of the Driftless area. She asked Wisconsin where the name came from. I spoke with Colin Belby, professor and head of the Geography and Earth Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. He explains that driftless means the absence of glacial drift, hence driftless. If glaciers had passed through this part of the state, they would have left behind rock material that geologists could connect to other regions.
If you drive around to many parts of Wisconsin, you'll find, for instance, crystalline rocks. They're rocks that come from northern Wisconsin or even up into Canada that don't match the local sedimentary rock types that are maybe found in the southern part of Wisconsin or the southeastern part of Wisconsin. Well, so southwest Wisconsin has evidence of glacial drift, glacial erratics, or glacially deposited sediments on all sides of it. But there is no evidence of these glacial deposits within the Driftless area.
So, what is the Driftless area like? Back by the stream at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve and surrounded by chirping birds, I meet with Marcy West on a sunny afternoon. She's a member of the state's Natural Resources Board and ran the reserve for 24 years.
By my definition, it just feels very untouched, like we can see the hills and valleys and get into it, explore it, really look at the diversity of the plants and the birds, and just enjoy the quiet and solitude in some areas like this.
As she's a stone's throw away from the Kickapoo River, West says the river is by far her favorite part of the Driftless area, especially when she's kayaking.
It just is such a gorgeous trip and an incredible way to see, again, those beautiful rock outcroppings and the huge pine trees and hemlocks hanging on to the rock outcroppings with the root systems, clear water, trout fishing, just the quiet and being able to see a variety of mosses and plants and birds in every season is definitely my favorite.
Belby, the UWL professor, also appreciates the area's diversity.
We have caves here. We have the big river, the Mississippi River. We have small streams. We have medium streams. It's just a really kind of diverse physical landscape that results in a very diverse kind of biological landscape. And also, I think, results in a very diverse cultural landscape. I think all those things are really, really tied together.
Whether it's the Baraboo Range with hills that cover thousands of acres in Sauk and Columbia counties, or the Mississippi River that separates Wisconsin and Minnesota, or Wildcat Mountain towering over the Kickapoo River in Vernon County, or Perot State Park, found at the confluence of the Mississippi and Trempealeau Rivers. Wisconsinites who have never seen the Driftless area can hop in their cars and chart a path through the southwestern part of the state that the last glaciers never did.
WPR's Jonah Balekas brought us that story on where Wisconsin's Driftless area got its name from. And that story idea came to us from an audience member as part of WPR's Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Three scientists were awarded the Nobel Prize for their work in quantum physics this week, specifically something called quantum entanglement. Let me see if I can explain. Let's say you have two coins, and you flip two coins, and that when one coin is heads, the other coin's always going to be tails, and the other way around as well, no matter what. That's the basic idea of quantum entanglement, as I understand it, except that instead of coins, it's tiny particles like electrons and photons. So let's say now you have one coin, and your friend who lives all the way, in Ohio, has another one. If these coins are quantum entangled, the distance between them doesn't matter. When you flip your coin, one side will be heads, and the other will be tails. But this gets crazier still. If you decide to change the result without telling your friend all the way over there in Ohio, say you got heads, then changed it to tails, well, your friend's coin over in Ohio will still be the opposite. How does that work? Of course, this doesn't happen with coin flips, but it does evidently happen with subatomic particles. So here to help us understand it all is Shimon Kolkowitz, Associate Professor of Physics at UW-Madison. He's an experimental quantum scientist who studies practical applications of quantum mechanics. Shimon, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Lee. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and how would you explain quantum entanglement briefly now that it's been at least acknowledged by the Nobel Prize?
Yeah, well, I think you did a great job, actually. Basically, the idea is that in quantum mechanics, which, as you said, governs things on very small scales, things like electrons, atoms, and the quantized units of light that we call photons, sometimes you can have a situation where you can't separate out the states of two different particles. So as you said, if you replace your coins in your analogy with two electrons, you might have two electrons where their states or their positions might actually be fundamentally intertwined such that you can't separate them. You can't talk about them individually anymore. And what that means, as you said, is if you take them and put them in two different places and you start messing around with one, it actually seems to impact the other one instantaneously. And that was something that really bothered Albert Einstein, for example, and he called it spooky action at a distance.
And you could understand why it would confuse Einstein, because everything I knew about his physics comes from high school, and we didn't know any of this. In fact, you had to be close to something in order to have an effect on it, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's a principle called locality. And usually in most areas of physics, we like to think that the physics that we're studying in that, you know, of that particular object, say that particle, is only determined by the stuff that it's right around it. And it always takes the speed of light for something else to impact it. So the further away you get, you know, the longer it should take for some change over somewhere far away to impact your particle. But in quantum mechanics, that just turns out not to be true. And that's actually what the Nobel Prize was given for, was actually really proving that that's not really how things work in quantum mechanics.
Yeah, and that was my next question, Shimon, is how much of this is theoretical, how much is practical, and how much of this is so brand new that we just don't know exactly what we're dealing with yet?
Well, that's a really great question. So we're really right now at about the 100-year mark for quantum mechanics. So we've understood most of quantum mechanics for about 100 years now. But it's very weird. It's very counterintuitive, even to people who study it every day like myself. It's just totally different from our everyday experiences. And unfortunately, also, you know, we live in a very what we call classical. We distinguish between quantum and classical. We live in a classical world. We use language that we've developed as kind of classical beings. And so it's actually pretty hard, as you can tell, even as we try to discuss it, to talk about the effects of quantum physics, because it's not something that we're used to, and it's so counterintuitive. Having said that, you know, what's remarkable is people like Einstein, you know, Einstein was really good at coming up with thought experiments. And he proposed this experiment, exactly like what you said, of taking two particles and pointed out that in quantum mechanics, they can be entangled, their states can be intertwined, and putting them on opposite ends of, say, the universe, and then doing this experiment. And he was trying to say, this can't be right. There must be something wrong with quantum mechanics. It must not be complete. That was basically his argument. And John Stuart Bell, who was a scientist at CERN in Europe, actually, but who happened to be visiting the University of Wisconsin on a kind of sabbatical when he wrote this paper, wrote a paper in 1964 showing mathematically that if you assume that quantum mechanics is missing something, you'll get a fundamentally different answer from doing certain kinds of experiments, kind of like the coin flipping experiments you were describing, than you would if quantum mechanics is correct. And even then, people thought, including Bell, this was kind of just an abstraction. It was a sort of a mathematical way to try to think about the different formulations and understand these things. But then the three scientists who just won the Nobel Prize, starting with John Clauser, working with a grad student, Stuart Friedman, in 1972, actually did the experiments. And sure enough, they showed that the results are consistent with quantum mechanics and not with any other theory, not with any theory where quantum mechanics is somehow missing something or where locality is preserved. So it's really reality, believe it or not.
Which is hard to believe when you've developed a Cartesian map of the world and you have time and space as Einstein linked the two. But now you've got spooky action at a distance, as Einstein called it. So what are the practical applications here, Shimon Kolkowitz? And let's start with what you're working on.
Oh, well, yeah, thanks a lot. So there are real practical applications. And, you know, what I work on is something called quantum sensing. We're trying to use these quantum systems and these kinds of effects like entanglement, superposition, the idea that particles can be in two different states or two different places at the same time to make really sensitive and precise measurement devices. Things like clocks, which I work on, that are turn out to be surprisingly important. For example, some of your listeners may or may not know that the GPS network, the way that you get instructions on your phone, actually relies on very precise atomic clocks, which are already a kind of quantum technology. We're trying to use some of these even stranger aspects of quantum mechanics, like entanglement, to make clocks even better. And I will say that when people did these original experiments, people like Clauser and Elena Spee and Anton Zeilinger, they initially were just trying to answer questions about the universe. But now part of the reason why I think they're being recognized for the Nobel Prize is we're on the verge of all of these new technologies based off of these discoveries and based off of these techniques. So things that people thought were really esoteric and academic and almost thought experiments have now turned into technological realities that are starting to change the world.
Technological realities. Shimon Kolkowitz, as it starts to change the world, how could this change for me? What would what could we see in our lifetimes that would be the revolutionary technology that we have yet to even imagine?
Well, that's a hard question to you know, prognosticate or answer. I mean, there's a lot of different things. So quantum technologies like quantum computers that can solve problems that all the computers we have currently, they don't really exist yet, but they're on the verge of becoming a reality. We think they could help with things like drug development, with developing new materials with properties that we can't even predict or haven't thought of yet. The kinds of sensors that I work on can help with autonomous vehicles, navigation, even with things like maybe predicting whether a volcano is going to erupt. So there is a huge range of different areas where these technologies will start to have an impact, and in some cases are already starting to have impact.
Yeah, so how does it move from theoretical to practical? What's that, and from your perspective, Shimon, what's that look like?
Well, it looks like doing experiments in labs, the kinds of experiments that these three scientists were awarded the Nobel Prize for, but also the kind of experiments that are happening in my lab and in a lot of other labs at the University of Wisconsin and a lot of other research institutions, of course. But I should say that the University of Wisconsin is actually a very special place. There's a lot of quantum science research going on here and a lot of these different technologies that we're talking about. And the other thing is that there's a lot of people doing that research. There's graduate students and undergraduates and postdoctoral researchers and faculty that are all involved in this work. And some of these scientists who just won the Nobel Prize, like Elena Spee, for example, he won for his graduate research. So I just like to encourage all of your listeners and especially people who are interested in science that, you know, you can all really get involved. And it's people who are doing this.
And maybe you someday, too, can prove Albert Einstein wrong.
Well, actually, we're using these clocks to test relativity. And so we recently did a measurement where we proved him right about something. Einstein was right about a lot of things, right, but he was just wrong about a few things.
Well, he just could not understand. What was his saying? Something about God doesn't roll the dice or something like that?
Yeah, that's right. He famously said God doesn't play with dice because he was really bothered about the fact that quantum mechanics is fundamentally random or non-deterministic. There's a story that Niels Bohr, one of the other sort of founders of quantum mechanics, famously told Einstein in response, don't tell God what to do.
Shimon, we're out of time, but I thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks a lot. It was my pleasure.
Shimon Kolkowitz, Associate Professor of Physics at UW-Madison, where the quantum physics are happening. He's an experimental quantum scientist who studies practical applications of quantum mechanics, and he talked to us about the science behind the most recent Nobel Prize in Physics.